Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Hello and welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, I'm delighted to have a special guest, Alia Khalili. Alia is a corporate psychologist and organizational consultant. She's been a professional partner of the Tavistock Institute for over 30 years, been on the staff of many group relations conferences, and was the first female director of the Leicester Conference. She's published extensively in the area of leadership and on systems psychodynamics in organizations and beyond into society. Alia was director from 1980 to 1995 for OPUS, the Organization for Promoting Understanding of Society, and she's currently chair. Alia, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
Not bad, Simon, not bad, thank you. In these COVID times, this is the best we can hope for.
The best we can hope for. They're difficult times. I was fascinated to discover OPUS when I started to get interested in psychodynamics in the Tavistock Clinic. I was studying there because my interest has always been wider than organizations and into society. Can you tell us a little bit about OPUS and how it started, its kind of founding history?
Well, it was founded by a scientist called Sir Charles Goodeve, who he was decorated for his work during the war in anti-mine systems. And after the war, he was one of the founders of operational research. How he got interested in what was going on in society, I'm not sure. But in the post-war era, he came into the commercial sector. And during the late 60s and 70s, he was quite perturbed by what he saw going on in industry, which was that workers were going on strike and there was a lot of turbulence. And so he developed this idea that if workers understood better the organizational, the aspects of the organization, particularly political aspects, and could see how they were being manipulated by the trades unions, they'd be less likely to go out on wildcat strikes. So I think this was quite a conservative attitude that he had. Anyway, he had this idea, and he approached the Tavistock Institute and met Eric probably in around 1974 or 75, must have been about 74, and asked Eric, could he develop this idea within the unit that Eric was then running at the Institute. And Eric thought it was an interesting idea, but it didn't quite fit with the vision of the work they were doing. So he wasn't too keen about that. And then Sir Charles approached the Industrial Society and asked the same question, and they felt the same. It didn't fit with them either. But both John Garnett of the Industrial Society and Eric encouraged Charles to set up his own organization, and that's how OPUS was born. So it was set up in 1975 as an organization without profit, a not-for-profit, as a charity. And Sir Charles had got quite a bit of money. He'd gone round to Rank Xerox and organizations, quite large organizations, and had managed to get some funding to begin to do the work. So Eric became the policy advisor. And the Industrial Society seconded one of their young people, the son of Lord Leathers, Jeremy Leathers, to help Sir Charles in this endeavour. So that's what happened in the very early years, 1975 to 79. Now, around that time, 79, I was being made redundant from my consulting role. They couldn't wait to get rid of me in industry. And it just so happened they had OPUS had these funds. OPUS needed some leadership. And Eric thought that I might be able to help kind of develop it a bit more. So he introduced me to Sir Charles. And in 1980, I took up the role of director.
So you were there very early on. And yes. What was it like in the early days? What kind of work did it do in the early days?
It actually, it was great fun. Because what we did was we got together a group of mates, basically, who became the founding group. You know, people like Miranda Feuchtwang and Tim Dartington, several, Brendan Duddy, Gordon Lawrence was part of it, all the sort of, you know, the key figures in group relations of those days. I think that what was important about Opus then, we have to think about the context, because the 1970s was the era of industrial democracy. And come the early 80s, which was, of course, the Thatcher era, we were in quite a recession. So the early preoccupations of Opus, the early courses that were offered, were all focused around work. Things like, can we make our organization a better place to work in, or stress at work, or am I doing the best job I can? We put on all sorts of little courses and began to do things, educationally, and also issues around unemployment. We developed a project called Creating a Livelihood, which was based on the idea of helping people rethink their relationship to the workplace. And this was, of course, to do with the fact a lot of people were having to go self-employed, because it was the end of the era of a job for life. I don't know what you were doing at that time. What would you have been up to then? You'd have been a young, very young person, I think.
I was in the turn of... from 1980s, like late 1970s, I was a nurse, general nurse. So I was trained as a nurse in 1977, and worked in Bristol as a nurse, and then in Yorkshire as a nurse. And it was all the miners' strike, Thatcherism, mass unemployment up in the north. You know, I kind of experienced all that kind of industrial turmoil, very political times, very kind of angry. Decimated at Manchester and Liverpool, decimated cities. I worked in Liverpool the later half of the 1980s, and absolutely decimated by this collapse of industry, really.
Absolutely. And we, in fact, were commissioned by a charity called Work and Society. They commissioned us to do some work in West Yorkshire. It was called the West Yorkshire Talkabout. I've still got the tapes of it, actually. And we interviewed pilot groups of mums and dads and school children and ethnic minorities and the unemployed. And they had very, very clear ideas then that, you know, if you weren't working, if you as a bloke weren't working, you weren't a real man. So you're not a real man without a job. So there was tremendous rage and impotence and people feeling they'd lost their masculinity. And of course, those were very traditional days. We don't think like that now, but they certainly thought like that then.
I mean, in the mid-1980s, I took 3 years off to be a single parent. And that was, like you say, it was like family, friends, like, what are you doing? Like, you know, men must work. It was like, you know, men don't stay home and look after the children. Men work. And like, you know, without work, you've got no identity. It was a very, countercultural thing to do.
Absolutely. And what made you do that? I know you're a maverick, Simon, and you always go against the trend, but what was the push factor for that?
Well, I separated from my son Finn's mother. We separated during the pregnancy, and we kind of decided to co-parent, and we were very good friends, and we co-parented the first year, and then one of us was going to go back to work, and we had a discussion, and his mother decided to go back to work, and I was very happy. I thought I'd stay at home and have 6 months with the baby and bond with him, and then I get bored. But I didn't get bored. I absolutely loved it, and I just kind of I think those 3.5 years as a single dad were probably the happiest of my life. It was just wonderful. Yeah, just really creative time. So I just really enjoyed it, and we just had an agreement together, and we co-parented during that time. But I was the one who didn't work and minded him, and I was going into mother and toddler groups and getting very strange looks. Like I was a bit of a punk rocker at the time as well, so I kind of wanted those haircuts and stuff, and maverick is a good word.
I'm sure the mums loved you.
Well, it is interesting that it's about society dynamics. It was like you got kind of different responses. You got three responses. You got kind of loved and at one level, you got mothered at another level, which is quite painful, and you got really kind of like you're in the wrong space, like this man should not be in this space. You got really kind of
Yes.
Cold-shouldered at the other level. So you've got kind of three different responses, but very interesting in terms of society and gender roles and stuff, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating. It's really interesting. So we did that. And the other thing we did in the early days, which I thought was really fascinating, we happened to know the governor of Wormwood Scrubs.
Right.
Who was an early member of Opus. And he enabled us to go into Wormwood Scrubs and do a project of the meaning of prison for society.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went in and we interviewed, apart from the governor whom we knew, we interviewed the assistant governors and the prison officers and the guys who had the dogs and also some of the prisoners. So I landed up in the cell of a murderer, interviewing him about his experience of being in prison. And that was absolutely fascinating. He told me why he was there. He was in this cell with his budgerigar in a cage. He had a little budgerigar. And he told me why he was there, which was that he killed his wife. But he said he didn't really kill her because it was only a penknife he used. And it was really the fact that when she fell backwards, she hit her head on the mantelpiece and, fractured her. Done it kind of thing. But anyway, he was making very good use of his time in Wormwood Scrubs. Mm-hmm. He was doing a degree in theology. Wow. Now, the irony of this, I mean, it's just to kind of put those elements together in your head. It was very, very interesting doing that having an understanding of the splitting in society. You know, have the soft governors and then you have the hard prison officers and you have this kind of split between the two and how they enact the maternal and the paternal elements of containing inmates.
Yes. Yeah.
Very fascinating.
I recall reading something. You published that work, did you? Because I recall reading something around the prisons, very powerful and very insightful. Yeah.
Yes. What we did in the early days, well, not so early days, for the first 10 years, we published, Eric and I really wrote it, a quarterly bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
And we published all this in this quarterly bulletin. And we did, I think, in the end, about 30 of them. And of course, we were working, it wasn't just us, we were working in a group with our colleagues. And the other thing we did, it was the beginning of the listening posts, which this idea, which really had come from wartime, whereby you were kind of trying to tune into what people were saying in society. We set up two groups. We set up, it was mostly a group of staff, actually, of us associates who met every 3 months to think about, well, what's going on in society. But because we weren't sure about what we were doing, we'd come up with some kind of ideas. And then we had another group of very mixed people, of ordinary people, you know, like unemployed and, different, representing different aspects of society. And we tried to check out these ideas with them. What did they think about this? I mean, were we talking rubbish? Well, were we just missing out certain angles? What did they feel about what we were saying? And then we published that in the bulletin as well. So that was the early days of listening posts. And then eventually, that second group whom we were testing our ideas out against, they became a listening post in themselves and they began to meet regularly. That's how the listening post started. So, and we had several, we had one in Scotland as well at some point, but the person who really took that forward was my successor in the job, which was Lionel Stapley, who really developed them internationally. And now we've got about 25 or 30 listening posts all around the world, meeting two or three times a year to look at what's going on both in their own societies and globally. And during COVID, of course, it's been very interesting because these groups were face-to-face groups originally. Yeah. They all met. Now they're all online. And the minute they went online, they absolutely rocketed up in numbers. So normally we have about a maximum of 25 people per listening post, so that gives time for people to kind of talk together and think together. But during the COVID time, the demand was very, very high because people were so isolated and, so disturbed by what was going on in society.
Absolutely. Ollie, where does psychoanalysis and the unconscious fit into Opus and your work? And can you say something about that?
Yes. Well, I don't think psychoanalysis certainly wasn't part of Sir Charles's mindset. I think this came from Eric, really. I think Eric introduced the system psychodynamic way of thinking about things. I think he was very taken by this idea, or the question, really, does society have an unconscious? I mean, if you can think about unconscious processes at the individual, group, and organizational levels, can you think about it at the societal level? And he and I wrote a paper in 1985 entitled Society as an Intelligible Field of Study, in which we tried, what we did was we gathered together all these listening post reports that we had, and we tried to see how this wove its way through what was going on in society. Could we say anything about it from an unconscious system psychodynamic perspective? And I think we had, well, it wasn't a bad shot, actually. We did, we wrote something fairly coherent about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think today the idea of society having an unconscious is much more engaged with. I mean, when we think about populist politics and we see what's going on around us, you can actually almost visibly see the unconscious at work, can't you? You can see it playing out.
You can. I mean, the other aspect of our focus was, of course, on the citizen, because this idea taken from Sir Charles, which was, you know, if the worker understood better how they were being manipulated, they'd be less likely to go out on strike. We took to another level, which was, can we help the citizen use their own authority more effectively? Yeah. Right. So we took it to the societal level, thinking about the citizen, not about the worker. And I think that has been actually a very useful concept, because it also embodies the idea of the citizen being a citizen of their organization, not just of society. That when we work in an organization, we're not just employees or subcontracted or whatever. We actually have some other role, which is dormant, which is we're a citizen, and collectively we shape our organization. So I think he took that notion, which we'd already used in industry in 1975, when he and I worked together. Yeah. We used that notion and implemented it in consultancy work. He took that out and made it bigger to think about, you know, what happens to our citizen roles in society, and this idea that whether you are active as a citizen or not, we still collectively shape the society we live in. So we live with what we've shaped, whether we like it or not, you know.
I mean, that's very interesting. I just written a book chapter for, I was invited to write a book chapter on the health service and well, not on the health service in the UK, international health. And it really, like my experience as a nurse and a psychiatrist was that when you become a patient, you get stripped of your citizenship. You become a dependent person and you lose your voice. And it's a very kind of expert-led field. Mm-hmm. And my whole kind of essay was about really how we need to develop a citizen patient, mm-hmm. how you have to retain your authority and have a much greater say in your care, and at the moment this kind of idea of kind of top down medicine is really not doing the work it needs to do. That public has to take more responsibility, get more engaged at community levels, at individual levels, and kind of shift this. But that idea of citizens is central to that idea. Yeah, so I think that's very helpful.
It's interesting. In fact, a friend of mine who's a doctor has recently also become a patient because she wasn't very well. And, you know, she talked to me about what an interesting experience it is to be on the other side, you know, and it's very much relating to what you're saying, actually, that you feel, she said it's been quite salutary, actually, to have that experience, to know what it feels like to be a patient as well as to be a doctor. So, yes, that sense of citizenship, I think, is important. But the problem is that there are these kind of underlying dependency feelings, aren't there? So when you're not very well, all this vulnerability rises to the surface, and you really are looking for, your citizenship self is kind of sinks a bit, because you're really wanting to be nurtured in some way or taken care of.
Yeah, no, I mean, I write about it, you know, and to the extent that when you're in surgery, you do hand over your citizenship, you hand over, you know, you become completely dependent, and rightly so. But it's not a kind of a vertical kind of a journey where you just have kind of a doctor, nurse, kind of a always a dependent patient. And until we engage patients in a much more collaborative way, where they have so much information about their own bodies, about their own desires, about their own needs, you know, that they can shape their own treatments and how we have to distribute kind of health much closer to the patient, much closer to communities, so that, you know, we hear community voices, different ethnic minorities have different kind of ways of understanding their bodies and their needs. So it's just that kind of real engagement of patient citizens so that we can kind of distribute health. And it's such a huge resource when you think about kind of all that knowledge people have about themselves, you know. And unless we kind of tap into that knowledge, it's a real kind of waste and an expensive kind of waste, because wrong treatments get done and people get kind of sent off to different places to get treated. But, you know, we have complex multi-health kind of challenges. You know, mental health and physical health are all entwined together, entangled together, and paying attention to that, it has to kind of engage people in a very, very different way. So, yeah, absolutely. And
yes, I agree. I think that's very important. I mean, I trust you to be always at the cutting edge, Simon. And I think the other thing, of course, that has fed into this is the internet, which provides so much either information or misinformation, whichever way you look at it. And I think it has helped people, and also the era we're in, which is the post World War II era, whereby people are much more challenging of authority than they used to be. Post-dependency, it's the post-dependency era, isn't it, really? And then there's the other side of that, which, you know, which we're seeing with the anti-vaxxers, if you like, you know, that they're using another lot of information to make their decisions. So it has consequences as well. Yes, in principle, I'm all in favour of encouraging people to use their authority. Also, particularly, we're living in increasingly authoritarian times. I mean, we're living in worrying times. About, you know, if we look at what's happening across Europe, well, not just Europe, but, you know, the mobilisation of a different kind of leadership in today's world, presumably because we're living in much more anxious times, more fragmented, more polarised. But the fact that trend is happening, it becomes really important that citizens use their authority, don't you think?
I think it's one of our greatest concerns, really. I'm directing a group relations conference in January called Networks of Desire. And we're exploring that, you know, the democratic deficit and our lack of freedom. And you can map it across, you know, like, there was great hope for China, for Russia, post-communist kind of Soviet Union, and then China becoming more democratic capitalist. There's great hopes. And there's been a shift in those countries back towards kind of totalitarian regimes. But then in our own West, you know, we have populist nationalist politics. We can see that on the rise. But also in our liberal progressive kind of groups, where we have cancel culture, where we kind of stop university professors having different views, There's a real clampdown on free speech and free thinking, and it's I think it's a huge concern.
It's really worrying. I agree absolutely. And the way in which people have been pilloried, it reminds me of the Witches of Salem.
Yes, yeah.
This is real persecution of freedom of thought and the perpetuation of sort of illusions and myths, and it's really worrying, actually. I'm concerned about that.
And you can see the unconscious work in there, you know, so the Kleinian ideas of splitting, you can actually see where people split off into we're the good self, we're the good group, they're the bad group, you know, whether it's the culture wars in America or Europe, you know, whether it's kind of trans rights against feminists, it's there's this splitting, constant splitting going on, and people finding it very difficult to hold that citizen role where we have to kind of work with difference and negotiate differences and tensions.
Yes.
And not just be right or wrong or good or bad.
Absolutely. Well, I think generally, you know, if we use the Kleinian thought, we're in a kind of paranoid schizoid state of mind, aren't we? We aren't in a sort of depressive position where you're looking at shades of grey and negotiating between shades of grey and debating the differences. When you're so polarised, if you're not with me, you're against me.
Yeah.
Now, there's no debate. I know I'm right and I know you're wrong, and ditto for you. So Yes, it is very concerning, and I'm just hoping it will eventually swing back the other way. But how that's going to happen, I don't know. Only by helping people perhaps really take up their citizen roles and think about what they're doing.
Does OPUS have a kind of mission around that project? Does it see itself as a research body now? I mean, is it going through changes? What's happening to it? Is it promoting citizenship? Is it just examining what's happening and reporting back?
Yes, very much so. The vision of OPUS is to help the citizen use their authority more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's an enabler. That's a kind of our one sentence vision, if you like. So we try and enact that in various ways. And over the last year, especially with COVID and having to go online, OPUS, it's an odd thing to say, it actually has blossomed.
We've
done a lot of events. We've had a lot of listening posts. We've put on a lot of, we've had book launches. We've brought together people to kind of discuss what's going on in society. We had a fascinating group relations conference about 6 weeks ago, which was totally co-created. I've never participated in something as unusual as that. There was no director. There was no directorate. The staff co-created the conference. And then they invited the members who'd already registered to have a pre-conference meeting to help get them to co-create it as well. And then the entire conference, as a group relations conference, it was like nothing I've ever been in before. But from the point of view of citizenship, it was fantastic because people had to use their own authority. There was no authority to rebel against because there wasn't an authority. It was very much like today's internet world. It was sibling authority. Very horizontal, very flat structure. And what people learned from it, I don't know. I'd love to have some feedback on it. But the staff had a great time with no director.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, one of my big interests has been social movements. And as a young man, I identified as an anarchist, but I was very interested in leaderless groups and challenging authority. And but very quickly learned that leaderless groups are that power does exist, that there's kind of informal power and there's power grabs and there's kind of they can become very toxic. And even recently I studied the Occupy movement. I went to did a research paper and studied the Occupy movement. And of course, they really identify as being leaderless, but you see leadership everywhere and then you see good and bad leadership. It's just not position power. So even in this group relations comes, I'm sure that kind of leadership was everywhere, but it's just how does it work without kind of a position power? And it's very, very interesting, you know.
It's interesting. I think the main issue with it that I think we all felt it was how long it takes, if you're going to work really democratically, how long it takes to come to thought through decisions if you don't do it with the what was seen as the kind of the paternalistic hierarchical structure. There are swings and roundabouts with it because I think overall, with leaderless groups like that, the research indicates that they tend to be much more satisfied as individuals with what is going on in the group and their own contribution to it compared to working within a hierarchical structure. Because one thing's for sure, everyone has their say and decision-making is joint and it does seem to work, but my goodness, it takes forever.
There's papers written that the tyranny of structurelessness, the feminist author was writing about the women's camps and how those decisions are, that there's clique groups and informal groups who kind of have more power than others. And it's just very interesting to watch it map out really and to see it. I mean, one thing I observed in the Occupy movements and in my own experiences of being in anarchist and activist groups was that they can very quickly kind of go off task, that they can fall in love with their democratic processes.
Yeah.
So that they have kind of so many processes and they invent very inventive, like, you know, the Occupy group, they have all these different hand signals and they have the the people's microphone where one person speaks and the crowd kind of shouts out their words. And it's all very nice and inventive, but they really enjoy it. It's almost like being a kind of festival or a party, and they forget that they're there to change the world.
It's quite absolutely. No, that sounds fascinating. That sounds one of our board members, a member of Extinction Rebellion, and of course they've been recently very involved in sticking themselves to roads for very good reasons, of course. But so I've been hearing a bit about this. It's very fascinating how you actually mobilise to bring about social change. Yeah. They feel they've been quite successful. But I think these dynamics about how you manage yourself in role, which you've been alluding to with the Occupy movement, I think that's very true for them as well. And we would expect it.
Yeah. And I think, I think Opus has a huge contribution to make, because it is flourishing, and it these times, I think we do have to explore different ways of understanding democracy. I think, I think that the current ways of voting and democracy in the West has left a lot of people feeling outside, which is why they go to populist politicians, which is why they feel left behind, they feel voiceless, We do have to think about new ways of understanding citizenship and understanding that engagement, and that, I think, yes, it's really, really important.
Yes, they're helping people find their voice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we don't have a very large membership of Opus, but people are clearly interested in the kind of events that we put on, because they are quite unusual. And it does, I think it does help them to use their voice. They have lots of opportunities to begin to try out using their voice. And I think that can be quite a confidence building experience for the individual who participates. And we don't do it for that reason, but gradually it becomes like a sort of, not exactly a family, but it has a bit of a family feel. And of course, we're all voluntary. We who run Opus, it's run on a completely voluntary basis. So it says something about our commitment as board members to, help the organisation develop. And this year, we put on loads of things. And after Prince Philip died, we actually coincided with his funeral. We were putting on an event to look at what's going on with the monarchy, what's the function of the monarchy for our society and the Commonwealth. We put that on. As you know, there was the event you led on Greta, which was, people absolutely loved that, fabulous. And that was, I think, our first scientific meeting. We brought back scientific meetings, and then Mark Stein has done one on gangs, which was also fantastic. We've had very good, big audiences coming to these, 100 people, 200 people coming to these events, so we really feel we are reaching out much more internationally rather than being seen as London-centric, which we were before, which I thought was a legitimate criticism, actually, because obviously I am based in London, most of our group, our members are sort of in Southeast England, at least.
Yeah, no, I've been interested in what COVID did to, my business has flourished in the same way that it's my coaching trainings and stuff. It's, we'd have 30 people in it turning up in a different country, and I'd go there and I'd teach. And now I had one class with kind of 40 people in, and we had Russians, Chinese, Americans, Australians. It was like,
fantastic.
It's really amazing, and the cross-fertilization of learning and sharing your experience is wonderful. It's interesting how some organizations have flourished in these spaces and some have kind of closed down and not grown. But where do you see Opus going now? I mean, what kind of areas are you liking to work in, and where do you see the next few years?
This is a process we're considering at the moment, actually. One of the things we're doing, given what happened with Black Lives Matter, we are looking at ways of collaborating with one or two other organisations, particularly at the moment with AK Rice. Of course, they're very concerned with the slavery movement in America.
Yeah.
I am much more concerned with present-day slavery myself, because I think that's the thing that's being denied. in the sense that, you know, there of course there are institutions that work on this issue in our society, but it's rather below the surface. It's not really very visible. And nobody seems to mind very much that we have present day slavery. I mean, talking about kind of like generally in the newspapers, there isn't a big hoo-ha about it going on all the time. So I thought this might be an interesting project to do with A.K. Rice. So we're looking at meeting at the moment. Yes. We're setting up a meeting of a group of our board and a group of them just to look at, could we do something like that? It doesn't have to be modern day slavery, but some joint project. So can we collaborate together on a project and see what comes out of it? Maybe over a period of time, you know, maybe over a year or two.
Yeah,
see,
yeah.
How can we find a way of working together across our cultures and countries and differences and similarities? Then when I think about this in a kind of, you know, macro way, Simon, this is the opposite of splitting and polarization, isn't it? It's trying, and as you were saying with your course, you know, bringing together, yeah, Americans and Chinese and, you know, Russians.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it's a much more integrative. So beneath the surface, you have that kind of, I'm sure lots of organizations are doing this. So that's one of the things we're doing. And the other thing I want to do is because by going international, we have actually managed to rectify our rather precarious financial position. It does mean that we could possibly allocate some funds for a project. So I want to talk to our membership mm-hmm. about, you know, what ideas they might have for what they think we could appropriately research, a project they might like to work on. So bring together them and us. It would be really interesting.
Yeah, so, very interesting. And, you know, the Ecoleadership Institute, which sponsors Edgy Ideas, has partnered with you and on the Greta, and we'd like to work with you more. It would be really, I think these partnerships and collaborations are really important as well with institutions, the kind of role model, collaborative kind of work, which is so important. I've just been thinking that you've mentioned Eric quite a lot on the show, and for those listeners who don't know who Eric is, you want to just explain?
Eric Miller, Dr. Eric Miller. Well, he was a very well-known organizational consultant. He, if you ever went to the Tavistock Institute before it moved to its current premises, and you looked at the board inside the door, it would say third floor, Dr. Eric Miller. So he was head of the group relations program, the Tavistock Institute, and he was one of the sort of, I'd say, really innovative thinkers about, organizations, thinking about them from a system psychodynamic perspective. And he worked all over the world. He did a lot of work in Mexico with the government there. He also worked in Panama. He really had a very major influence, I think, in our field.
Yeah.
And of course, I had the great good fortune, having not got on with him at all well in the first years that I knew him, I did eventually change my mind, and we were happily married for 20 years. So,
I thought it'd be bigger to share with the audience. I mean, Eric's writings and his work were foundational in my thinking. It's really, really wonderful kind of work he did, like you say, and I think really, really had an impact. So thanks.
He wrote one of the books he wrote was called From Dependency to Autonomy,
yeah.
And in that book there is actually quite a biography of him in the introduction that he wrote. But on the book launch was held at the Tavistock Clinic, actually, where the Tavistock Institute was located in the clinic in those days. And the book launch, Isabel Menge's Life was the one who introduced. She was actually the sort of maitre d' of the event. She introduced him and it, except she said, right, I really want to introduce this wonderful book to you, From Autonomy to Dependency.
A four-minute slip.
Wonderful. How true. Yeah. First you go from dependency to autonomy, and then you go back again.
That's wonderful. Olya, listen, it's been lovely talking to you. I ask all my guests a question at the end of the show, so I'm going to ask you, have you any thoughts on what it takes to live a good life and create a good society? With all the work you've done, I'm sure you've got some thoughts.
I think, yes, work on your inner conflicts, because if you can reduce the kind of conflicts inside yourself, you will be a happier person. That is the first thing. The second thing is, whatever work you do, do work that you feel passion for. You need to be passionate about what you do in life, because this is where your life force goes. And that means doing work that is a good fit for your personality, whether you're employed or self-employed, whether you're a conformist or a maverick, however, whatever you are, put your passion into your work as well as into your family life, and you will be a happy person and you will help to create a happier world.
Wise words, Olya. And clearly you've been passionate about Opus and all the work you've done, and keep it going. It's really wonderful work. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Simon. Lovely talking to you, and good luck with your work as well, which, as we know, is edgy.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you all for listening to Edgy Ideas Podcast this year. We've had some wonderful guests, and I'd like to thank them all. And thank you all as an audience for listening and sending messages. We've had great numbers this year, so thank you for your generosity and engagement. Next year, there'll be more Edgy Ideas Podcasts. We're sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. And if you'd like to partake in some of our webinars, we have an active community of practice. Many of our podcast guests will be appearing on our webinars. You can engage with them live. To do so, go to www.eco-leadership.institute. If you go to events, you'll see our membership to sign up and be part of this edgy community of practice. Have a great holiday season all, and be with you next year.